Scribbler's Corner is brought to you by Brad Kuhn and Associates and the Jacks by Jacks Literary Arts Festival.
Hey, y'all. Welcome to Scribbler's Corner, the podcast about writers and writing, broadcasting from River of Grass Studios, where two rivers meet and you never know who will tie up to the dock for a chat and a fresh cup of coffee. I'm Darlin Finch Kuhn, but my friends call me the Scribbler. Yvette Angelique Hyatter Adams is the principal and chief storytelling officer at Narratives for Change. Born in Washington, D.C., she attended Parkdale High School in Riverside, Maryland, and studied liberal arts at Riverside Community College before earning a Bachelor of Science in Occupation, Education, and Workforce Training at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale. Hyatter Adams obtained a master's degree in transformative language arts, creative and expressive writing, and social change at Goddard College, and a graduate certificate in creative writing from the University of Denver. She's a former regional envoy at the U.S. Department of Arts and Culture and now lives in Atlantic Beach with her musician husband, Kenny. Yvette, welcome to Scribbler's Corner.
Thank you, darling. It's a delight to be here.
Well, we wanted to have you on the show a lot sooner, but you're so busy. I'd like to go over some of the events you've recently been involved in and also tell our listeners a little about your personal writing journey today. Is that okay?
Oh, that'll be terrific.
Okay, great. Now, I just learned something interesting about you that I didn't know before we had lunch today, and that was that you are also a musician.
That's where I started my creative chops as a musician. Yes, as a child musician. From the time I was 6 years old, I played the organ, the guitar, and songwriting. So my life as a poet and essayist today is really based off my music life.
Wow. Now, last Saturday, you read your work in Yellow House in a collaboration with Bards and Brews at a joint fundraiser for the Yellowhammer Fund in Alabama and the Coalition for Consent here in Duval County. So tell us what that was all about.
That was a terrific event curated by Carrie Foster, and she did a fantastic job. She was able to pull together four readers, and we all had different backgrounds and genre style of creative writing that we could tell these stories about our experience as women experiencing oppression as it relates to all areas of oppression, our race, our gender, as it relates to having our choice over our bodies, choice over our decisions. It was a very powerful experience to not only be a reader, but also a listener of stories. Then there was an open mic portion where women and men came up to share experiences. And I know they're going to do another one in July sometime. So, you know, if you didn't make this one, stay tuned, look at Yellow House, plug, plug, plug for Yellow House as a way to get on the calendar, because it was really a powerful reading.
Yes, we'll be looking forward to the next one. And what did you read while you were there?
I shared an experiential piece. I've been working on experimental piece, I should say. I used a video of a girl, an Asian girl who was about 3 years old. I opened up with that video. It was something that went viral on the internet, but it was a powerful story that this, she was about 3 years old, where she spoke about to her mother about how she was experiencing her mother and father's behavior as they were engaged in this divorce. But I think the most powerful part of her storytelling was from this mouth of a babe. She was sharing about what she imagined for the world and what she wanted from her mother and father in terms of how they communicated to each other and what it meant to her about being connected and what kind of peace that she wanted to see between them and the world. And for me, that's set up my writing about wanting to be heard, wanting it to be a space of peace, wanting it to be a space of telling the truth about what I see and how it impacts me. So I was taking this voice from a babe, and then I shared a poem that was a pantoum that I had written, and then I shared a prosy storytelling piece about my experience being in a circle of women who gathered annually for about 10 years, over the course of 10 years, every once a weekend, once a year, that was called Retreat, Recreate, Renew. And it was all Black and brown women who gathered together where we could be in a circle facilitated by two incredibly talented Black women therapists, where we could tell our truth about what it was like being in us and our skin. And it was a very safe space to do something. So it was very transformative for me. And I wrote about that experience. So it was a nice weaving in and out for me. And it was something that I wanted to play with. And in Yellow House, it's a great space to do this sort of storytelling and this type of creative writing and expression, and to share it in front of the audience and to, you know, get a reaction back from the audience.
Tell us about your writing journey or your practice. Mm-hmm. How did you get from Washington to here, and how do you incorporate writing into your life?
Oh, okay. You want to go pour that glass of wine right now?
Sure.
It's a long story.
Well, we've got time.
We've got time. Well, I've always been a creative. So writing stories, telling stories started out as music. It was the way that I could process my emotion, my pain, my disconnect as a young child. Unfortunately, I had experienced a murder in my family. My mother's brother was murdered when I was 10, and that really threw a shockwave, not only through our family, but it really changed how we were living our lives for the rest of our lives. And when you're a kid growing up in Washington, D.C., and it was during the early 70s, so there was a lot of turmoil going on in the country, and race relations, gender relations, all that was overwhelming. You get lost in that. And so the way that I could make sense out of that experience was to create music on my organ, then my guitar, and I always wrote songs. And that was the way I could make sense out of my life. So music and writing has been the way it has really saved my life. It's been the way I've been able to navigate the world. So I am such an advocate about music and arts for children and young people, because this is the way that we can not only express ourselves, but this is the way that we really kind of create our spiritual sense of self.
I see. And what about your writing practice now? Mm-hmm. How does that look?
Well, I'm pretty dedicated to a writing practice. Mondays are my writing days. And I also write other than Mondays, but pretty much I dedicate Mondays to writing. And when I know I can't write on Monday, I select another day during the week. But my idea is that every moment or every week, at least I can sit down and just whatever it is, whether I'm working on a project or if I'm really, oh, I don't feel like working on this project, I just open up a book. And I start to read, and I said, let me just write about what I'm reading. Let me reflect upon what I'm thinking about what I'm reading, whether it be poetry or essay, or I might take a prompt and really go to town on it, or I may start with a dream. So there's some things that I use to get started on writing for the week. That's what I do in terms of my regular practice. Then I have moments on my schedule where I go in and I actually plan to do revision work on pieces that I'm working on. I also teach and write what's called scholarly personal narrative. Mm-hmm. And that is to use a personal essayist approach to quantitative research. And so I do that for myself in my own research, work with transformative narratives as a model that I work with. And I also support other writers who are using that work in graduate school or in their professional life when they want to write about their research, but to use a more personal essay voice in order to do that.
I see. Now, you are holding a 4-week summer creative writing intensive for teen girls this summer. I have on my notes from July 9th through August 1st.
Yes.
And it's for writers between the age of 14 and 18. And then there'll be a performance reading on Friday, August the 2nd. Mm-hmm. Now, is that where you practice some transformative narrative? Or mm-hmm. tell us about that workshop.
Yeah. So let me tell you, yeah, about the workshop with the girls. You know, for the last few summers, I've had parents beg me, Yvette, we need something for our teen girls. We need for them to write. And I go, okay. So I approached about 20 women in this town in Jacksonville. And I said, help me. I am looking for sage mothers, is what I call them, to invest in not only girls and their voices here, but I also wanted to develop and train two apprentices. One is an apprentice and one's an intern. I want to develop and train them on the transformative narratives model that I use as a part of my writing practice. And I'm interested in really spreading how I do this work. I've been using this particular model for over 17 years in different communities, both locally, nationally, and internationally. I've received all kinds of wonderful feedback. I've written research articles on it. And the bottom line is that in the communities that I've used this model of writing, women in particular, because it's mostly women who have used it, although there have been men who have used it, they have collectively said, this was a powerful process for me to really write creatively, for me to heal, for me to feel like I had some leadership around my voice. And now I want to do something, whether it be personal advocacy work or maybe even advocacy work in my community. So I'm really interested in really spreading this way of leading workshops, leading community voices, leading stories in the world. So I need to, you know, train some people how to do that. So part of this is not only offering the workshop for the girls, but also developing two women in our community. A woman who is what I call elder apprentice. This is a woman who is repurposing her skills to learn how to do this. And then I have an intern who is going into college in the fall. And so she is interested in doing this type of work in the world. So they're both women. And so I'm interested in having them be skilled to do this.
I see. And if a young woman wants to be involved in this, does she still have time to sign up? And how does she do that?
Oh, that's a great question. Yes, we have some spots still available. So I would welcome the opportunity. Anybody that's interested can give me a call on my personal cell phone, right? How about that?
How about it?
At 609-636-0049. You can also reach me at yhyeter, that's H-Y-A-T-E-R, at Gmail. yhyeter@gmail.com.
Wow, fantastic. So jump on that, young ladies. Now, you have a real heart for creative collaboration. I've noticed that in your activities around town. And I understand you're working with poet Tiffany Melanson from the Douglas Anderson School of the Arts to present a writer's summer studio for poetry and essays. Because I was getting a little jealous of the young ladies and wondering if I dyed some of this gray hair, if I could come, but maybe I'll try this other avenue instead. You've invited writers to blow off work on Friday, July 26th, and come create together from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the beach. How do we get involved, and what will that experience be like?
That experience is going to be wonderful, too. Yeah, Tiffany Melanson is a wonderful poet. She and I have collaborated on other things before. She has invited me to participate and lead workshops at Douglas Anderson many times. And she and I have talked about doing this sort of thing in Jacksonville. And I said, we're just going to do it this summer. This is a space where writers who are interested in coming in and working deeply in a manuscript that they're already working on, or if they're saying, look, I'm in a creative slump. I just need a space where I can just focus on me for the day and just write deeply. And within that space, I believe in good food, good nurturing food, a creative space, and a process where writers can come together and exchange feedback on anything that they're working in the moment, and also getting some tips, ideas around craft. Mm-hmm. To support wherever writers are in that moment. So we are looking for people who are probably already writing. This is probably people who are already writing, who want to go deeper with something that they're already working on, or want to be motivated to maybe do some new work. So that would probably fit best for this group. For writers who are more at the beginning level, I'm going to do something that's going to be on the last Friday in August.
Oh, okay. Right.
So somebody said, I may want to try this writing thing, so I'll have a one day. And what's important about the blow off Friday from work, because we don't do this for ourselves. Mm-hmm. People are like, what do you do on the weekends? Well, on the weekends, you're doing laundry, you got grocery shopping, you want to be with your kids or your family or whatever. So I say, take a Friday off from work, treat yourself, it's the summer, and just give yourself a personal retreat for the day. Mm-hmm. And that's why I said blow off Friday.
Oh,
of course,
I love it.
Yeah, so people laughed at that. Goes, you know, you bet it's a pretty good idea.
Well, you know, don't tell my boss, Brad Kuhn, who's actually sitting on the other side of the desk here, that I'm going to do that. But it sounded really nice, the day at the beach with other writers, rather than being at work.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I know that I heard you lead just a few weeks back an amazing group of young poets in a reading at the Augusta Savage exhibit at the Cumberland Museum of Art in Riverside. And I was wondering, how did Savage's art influence your work and the work of that group?
Oh, such a great question. Well, I know that when Augusta Savage exhibit was coming to Jacksonville, I was approached by the Cummer, and they wanted me to curate a literary event. I had done that before when the Ink, Silk, and Gold exhibit was in town. I curated a literary event and poets from the 12th century. It was a wonderful experience. And I enjoyed doing that. And when we talked about the Savage exhibit, I knew about Augusta Savage on the peripheral, you know. And then I said, well, you know, yeah, I'll go ahead and curate that. And so then I had to do my little research about Augusta Savage. And boy, what a powerful awareness. Mm-hmm. I saw an artist who was not only passionate about her own work as a visual artist, but she was just as passionate about mentoring young people. And through the Augusta Savage experience and story, I could see my own passion.
I see.
About being an artist and about working with young people, mentoring people to be the best artist they can be. And that's important for me. And then it was real easy to say yes to this project. And I said, you know what? Since this, instead of me just curating a literary event, why don't I work with some young people like Augusta Savage and we curate new work? We develop new work and add that into the reading. So that's what we did.
Yes, there was a lot of information about Savage herself, mm-hmm. and we were surrounded by her work and photographs of her and her proteges, and then these beautiful young women got up and read their work that had come out of that, and it was quite powerful.
Yeah.
I won't ever forget it.
It was really good. And the thing that made it special was, and got a lot of support from the comer on this, is that it was important for me to not just have the women, the young women who worked with me on this, to create new work in a vacuum as part of their quote-unquote school, because it was from, we selected writers from Douglas Anderson School of the Arts, but I wanted them to be paid for their work. And so I said, you know what, we have got to get out of this starving artist mindset.
Amen.
And so I insisted that the girls be not only paid for their reading, but be paid for creating new work. And so we were able to give them a stipend for, you know, creating new work, and also for the reading.
Fantastic.
And that was important. Of course, I got paid, to do that as well, because this is what I do for work in the world. But it's also important that artists realize that, yes, it takes time and energy to create new work, and you need to be paid for that.
Absolutely. And I applaud you for that. We seem to ask writers to be the ones who contribute their work for free or for exposure, that lovely word.
Yeah.
And, exposure doesn't pay the light bill or put food in our bellies, does it?
Exactly right. My husband and I, we laugh about it. We call it the public relations gig.
Uh-huh.
We get asked for more public relations gigs than we get asked for paid gigs. And it's actually an insult to artists to think that, you know, we can ask for their talent to make whatever we're working on better, profitable, you know, for someone else, and not be paid for it.
Right.
Or to be underpaid for it.
And what a gift you gave these young women, that at their age, you said to them, what you're doing is valuable. It should have a practical reward as well as the intrinsic reward of doing the work itself.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I mean, one of the Savage Writers is actually the intern that's working with me for the summer creative writing project.
So
she will continue to work with me and be paid.
There you go.
A paid internship, not a free internship.
Yeah. Now, you're such a wonderful nurturer of the young people, but who helped you on your way up? Who was... I have a feeling there were some wonderful people who helped you along, because you're such a giver.
Well, I did. When I was 13, I had Signe Bush, who was my guitar teacher. And she has no idea how she influenced my life. And she was an amazing person. She is still around. She was amazing to me at the time in my life where I needed to the most, as I shared with you. We had a tragedy in our family, and I just needed someone to just hold a container in a space. So it wasn't like she was some person that I confided in and I had all these deep conversations, but she really held a nice container for me to create. And I was in her guitar class for about 3 years. And when I went to high school, she asked, I guess it was for about, I can't even remember how many weeks it was. I don't know whether it was weeks or months, you know, so long ago. But she was needing a substitute guitar teacher to take over her class. And she wanted me to come do that. And I was in high school.
Wow.
And that was my first job. I was a guitar teacher to run her class while she was away, and I got paid for it. And that was something that was important for me to know at that time, was like, wow, you know, I knew I was good. I was taking private lessons. I was classically trained musician. And so I had skills, but that was my first job. And then after that, I had several other guitar teaching jobs at studios where I got paid very well. And back then, I mean, I was making like $25 an hour.
Nice.
And that was back in the 70s,
yeah.
The early 80s. You know, that's good for people now, but yeah. I'm just thinking back then it was real good.
You bet. Well, good. And I hope that she gets to hear this podcast and hear your words of appreciation. And if she's If you don't think she's going to hear the podcast, I hope you'll write her a letter and tell her what you just told us, because, boy, I bet it would make her month.
Well, not only have I haven't written her a letter, but I actually wrote a chapter in my book of essays. It's called Complicated Truths, A Woman Emerging as Leader of Her Whole Life. It's my book of essays I've been working on. And a chapter is dedicated to mentoring. And she shows up in my stories. So she's a very powerful mentor for me.
Well, good, good. I know she'll love hearing that when your book is ready. Would you read some of your work for us? I want to make sure that we get that in. And I think you mentioned that you would read an essay, or is it a narrative poem?
Yeah, it's a narrative poem. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I did over the years, you talked about my writing practice. And while it was happening, I didn't even realize it was a writing practice. So this predates the internet. It's an avid letter writer. And I wrote letters to friends, family all the time because my husband was in the military, so we lived far away from home. I lived in California, and our family was in Washington, D.C., as well as all my friends. So I had about two or three friends, and then my sister I would write to on a regular basis. And they used to tell me getting those letters was like gold. You know, it was so, it was like I was totally in the space in the world that you were talking about. So writing letters and letter writing is an important genre for me that it's more essayist. So this particular poem is a letter to Edgar Allan Poe.
Oh, my.
One of my favorite writers as a young person, and even today, I love him. So it goes like this. Dear Edgar, Vincent Price is your face to me. On Saturday mornings, I sit in a dark paneled basement on evergreen tile floors, laying on what Ma calls a pallet, an old country word for a thick stack of raggedy comforters as a makeshift bed. Me and my sister sit wrapped around a big silver bowl with Jiffy Pop stovetop popcorn and a jelly glass of grape Kool-Aid. We watch for the latest horror show on DC's local Channel 5. Black and white reruns feature Abbott and Costello, our hero buffoons, in suspenseful and comical spins on Frankenstein, Dracula, and the werewolf. But most chiseled in my mind is your melodic poetry, dear Edgar, as it falls from the lips of Vincent Price. His tall, menacing glare, his face contorts, a ghastly leer, just as you describe from the pages of your words. A story of a large black bird, a tapping at the window, rustling from the ivy that climbs the lattice leaning next to the house. And with the same stroke of a pen, you, as Vincent Price, convince us it's our imagination, that our mind is acting silly from the late night of sip of red wine before bed. But we, like the poor soul in the flick, hear the screeching and the creepy talk we believe spoken by that bird at the open window. Our skin crawls because we don't know if the fowl with the fiery eyes is a prophet, a bird, or the devil. This is what you ask in three stanzas, so we wonder too. Oh, dear Edgar, our breath quickens at each line, our eyes wide open. We keep reading, keep watching for what Vincent Price will do next. Each page of that poem we watch as a movie while you show us, Edgar, you show us just how easy we create our own madness out of a night sound, bent shadows, beast at rest.
That was powerful. That takes me back. You're right. Getting a letter like that would definitely put you in a different place.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, I love some of the old books. When I growing up, it seemed like a huge library. It was like a wall full of books in my house. And my mother was a big reader. And she had Edgar Allan Poe, Agatha Christie, Sherlock Holmes, James Baldwin. It was a lot of books on my shelves. And I didn't know what they all meant. I would just pick one and just start reading one. So I'm going to read every book on that wall. I can remember thinking that as a kid.
Did you make it?
I made it.
Yeah.
Pretty much. And we had those encyclopedias. And right. Now we don't even use those anymore, right?
So, they're in our phone now.
Yeah.
Could we have imagined that?
That
the entire Funk and Wagnalls set would someday be held in the palm of our hands.
In the palm of our hands.
It's crazy.
It really is.
That exciting.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Well, thank you for reading that. And you have quite a reading style, too. It's mesmerizing. So
thank you. Very nice. Thank you.
I wanted to switch gears just a little bit. Because I know that you're quite involved in Jacksonville in social justice activities, such as the recent Alternate Roots Weekend that was held in the Cork Arts District. And I'd kind of like to get some ideas from you on what your role is there and what you envision for the city and what people can do to help and become involved in social justice.
Well, I think I will open by saying that, you know, social justice really starts at a personal level and moves through looking at systems. And you can, you know, look at it either way, because systemically, and what I mean is like institutions that we all have to navigate in. They work for some, they don't work for everyone, right? And what I see as an artist and my work in Narratives for Change is really through storytelling, to use it as an art for healing, for leadership, and for advocacy. And I particularly like to focus on working with women and girls and using it as a tool. And it's also important for me to look at the community I live in, about the stories we all live in, the narrative that we're all living in. Coming to Jacksonville 6-7 years ago, it's a very powerful arts community here. It's also very fragmented. It's kind of widespread. You have people kind of doing their own thing. And their own thing could be trying to create, to trying to use artist advocacy for justice, to make people aware of what's happening in our city, voices that are invisible to become visible. And working with Alternate Roots, I'm a member of Alternate Roots, and I wanted to see Jacksonville artists, activists, cultural workers come together and say, how do we work together to collaborate, to make visible things that work and don't work in our community, and create change using creative means, also using disruptive means, also using collaborative means. All those things are important when you're looking at changing systems. And so working with Alternate Roots really gave us tools. As an organization, Alternate Roots has been around for 43 years, has a lot of resources, if you will, to help artists and activists really look at ways that we can collaborate and create together to change how our community, to really create these spaces of belonging. That's what it is, bottom line. You know, I want a world and I want a community where people feel like they belong. And that's not the case here in Jacksonville. That's not case and spaces all over, if you will, communities. And how do we bring that together? And that's bringing together people, neighbors, our politicians, our businesses, our nonprofits, how do we create these communities where people feel like they have a place here, that they can contribute here, that they can add value here? And that's what's important. And so the work of Alternate Roots is working with the art and cultural workers and social justice activists to collaborate in that work.
Great. And if someone wants to become involved with Alternate Roots, what do they do?
Well, first place to go is check out the Alternate Roots website, okay? And that's www.alternateroots.org. Okay. So that's the easy way to look at it. If you would like to be involved in Jacksonville, again, I can be reached by email at yhyater@gmail.com. And I'm happy to provide additional information when we get together. And, you know, it's a slow gathering, moving, unpacking, learning together, organizing together process. And so when I say slow, I don't mean that we're not trying to get anything done. What I'm trying to say is that we know as artists and activists, we have to do our own internal work of building our awareness, healing, and then learning how to collaborate together. Because I think that's the big obstacle. When you're in the when you're in a system, you're not organizations, but when you're in a system, a city where things are spread out and fragmented, then people need to learn how to work together in ways that feel productive and feel as though that we're really supporting the mission of what we're trying to do in creating spaces of belonging.
Absolutely. I'm wondering about in your journey growing up, becoming a writer, you know, going through the hardship that was caused by your uncle's death. What obstacles have you faced and overcome, or faced and they won? Sometimes that's the a bump in the road. Talk about your obstacles and what you've overcome to be the person and the advocate that you are today.
I think my first challenge as an artist was and not having that be valued. You know, growing up in the 70s, you know, we supposedly overcame. And so I really believe I had these choices that I could be a musician if I wanted to. And, you know, my parents were like, what? No, you don't go to school. You need to go to business, or you need to figure out, you know, it was the whole starving art. How are you going to take care of yourself? And so I was really disrupted by, you know what, I can't be an artist. So I went into the business world. I was in retail, and I became a retail executive. And then I went into banking, and then I later became a bank executive. From being a bank executive, I became president and CEO of a consulting firm, a management consulting firm. So I've had all these kind of badges of what people call a success. You know, these are the things you want to grow up and become. And, but here I am, you know, an executive with this, you know, wonderful office and all these clients and wonderful people. And I just, this is not what I want to be doing. You know, I'm sneaking time away to write. I'm ditching away hours at midnight. I'm doing, you know, so it's like, I really need to shift what I'm doing. I really need to do what I was put here to do, and that's be an artist. So how do I take all those wonderful things that I learned along the way in terms of my management, executive, corporate life, and do the thing that I was meant to do? And that was to be a full-time writer, not be a part-time writer doing part-time teaching artist work, but to make that a full-time writer, full-time teaching artist, and then, you know, how does that work with my consulting practice? And that is what I did when I moved to Jacksonville. And so
yeah. That was about 8 years ago. You took the leap from the corporate executive world.
About 2012. I was president and CEO of Prime Directive Consulting Group, and then I was president of NTL Institute as an interim president and in Washington, D.C., and then I came here. And I said, I will now do this. And that's where Narratives for Change started. So I still use my narrative work to work with teams and leaders and looking at ways they can become more effective using narrative process. Mm-hmm. And my focus is in how do I write about these things and how do I teach in communities these story circles and writing groups as a way to engage in conversation and write and collect stories. And that's really what I'm about. Yeah.
I know that the words that you use are transformative narratives. So without betraying anyone's confidence or violating their privacy, can you tell us a story or two about writers that you've seen use the process and then actually transform, mm-hmm. Have their lives changed because of that exercise? I'm very interested to know the outcomes of some of these powerful writing sessions.
So I'll give you a concrete example. The transformative narratives is a model I created when I was in graduate school at Goddard College, because I really wanted to look at, wow, I lived this life as a change management consulting firm leader, you know, in that world. And I've also had this world as a creative writer. How do I put those two together? So that was what I really unpacked and learned when I was in graduate school. So what I learned was, you know, through different aspects of study, I've created this model called transformative narratives. And I went out to the community and I started doing work with women in particular, because I really wanted to focus on women. So this would be around 2001, to September 11th. Probably about a good year. No, yeah, maybe about, not even a year, maybe a few months to a year afterwards, almost a year. I was working with a group of women in Philadelphia. And in that circle of women, there was one woman who was referred to me by a therapist to come to this workshop, to come to my workshop. And she would come every week. It was a 10-week program. She would come every week. She would write. And we would write together. And part of the process is that we would read whatever we wrote if we wanted. And so every week she would write. And she didn't read. She never read. So we never heard her speak. Right. So on the last day, of the last day of the workshop, it was a weekly workshop. So on the 10th week, we wrote a piece. I don't remember what the experience was, because I would have these experiential exercises, you know. And I don't remember what it was. But she wrote, and she decided to read what she wrote. She wrote about being in the tower that fell. She was a Wall Street analyst. She was a broker. She was in the building. She had to run down the stairs to get out of the building as it was collapsing. The building fell on her and her coworkers as they were running down the stairs. She saw people she worked with die behind her, beside her. She was covered with soot from head to toe, and her ears were ringing as she was in a daze, not knowing what had happened. People were confused. She woke up in a hospital. She doesn't even know how much time went by. She didn't know where she was. She didn't know her name. But she sat in this hospital, not knowing that her family frantic looking for her. When she finally was able to make some sense of herself, she could reach out to her family and she could, get back with her family. But she couldn't leave her house after that. She was afraid. So she was trying to work through, of course, her trauma. And she was recommended to attend this workshop. And through those 10 weeks, she listened and she wrote about her experiences, but she didn't read about it. But in that space, what she read to us was so powerful. And we responded to her writing in very nurturing, loving, and powerful ways. Afterwards, she wrote me, and she also talked to me some as well, but she wrote me, and she told me that that was such a powerful gift for her to have had the experience of having a nurturing and loving space to write and not be pressured to talk, to have space to have her story read, for her to read it, to have people not ask her questions, but just to respond to what she read, and to have it stay in that space and nobody call her later on and wanted the 411 or her story in her life, but just to have that space to do that. That it shifted something in her, and she was stepping outside of her house writing this letter for the first time in like months. She was outside. And subsequently, she was able to get herself in a space where she could go back to work. But it took her years to be able to go outside, to navigate community on her own, to be able to drive again. Because the trauma was that, you know, significant. But she talks about that space as the beginning of her ability to transform her narrative.
That's an incredible story.
And I have about 10 more like it.
Wow.
Tens and tens mm-hmm. more. That's why I knew that moving to Jacksonville, that would need to be my full-time working world. And to also train other, particularly women. I want to work with women and men, but to work with women and men to skill them up on how to create these spaces so that people can be in this storytelling space in a nurturing and caring way.
It's a wonderful mission. I hope that people will take advantage that we've got this here and it's available to us.
Yeah, because I see art as not only a space where you can create, but it's also a space that you heal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a place where you advocate for yourself or for others. And so that's what my business Narratives for Change is about. And that's why it's an important work for me.
So that the change is sometimes deeply internal and personal, like the story you just told, but it's also about transformation in areas of social justice and systemic problems.
Absolutely. Because even, you know, as I told you about the essays that I'm writing, I'm changing my own narrative as I write about my stories. But my stories are about my Black woman's experience. Mm-hmm. So even in spaces where, you know, oh my goodness, you had all this success. It's like, yeah. And in spite of, I wonder what it would have been like if I didn't have these barriers, if I didn't have multiple instances of sexual harassment, multiple instances of having to advocate for equal pay, multiple instances of fighting for resources so I can do my job. And even, you know, with not having all the resources and some of the jobs that I had, still coming out as a top performer and the company recognizing, oh, this is our top performer. It's like, but look at everything you did to block mm-hmm. that possibility. And I'm happy to be here at the table. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, that's a hard thing to live with. And it is my story. So, you know, this whole piece around access, opportunity, having a seat at the table. Yeah, I've had those, but it was at a price.
And imagine what you could have accomplished had you been given some of the hands up that other demographics are given.
And for me, it's just like, hey, just to have what you had, you know, nothing like, oh, we want to give you a promotion and all these wonderful things, but oh, but you don't have a budget. So, well, how am I going to? And here are your goals. Well, how am I going to do this? And I don't have a budget. Like, how does that work? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, I mean, just impossible things with no resource. And so, I have tens and tens and tens of stories of this, and I know I'm not the only one.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, I'm curious to know what's coming up and what I have not asked you that you'd like the world to know about you and your work. And maybe your goals, to use a word that we just what are your goals in life?
My goals in my life is to slow down. Actually, my real big goal is really to do a lot of reflecting and handing over. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would really love to be able to teach and train others to do what I do. Who are really authentic around wanting to see these kind of changes happen in our community. Not just our local community, but I'm talking about our world community. One of my many hats in the world years ago was I was a programmer. I worked for the Department of State, and I was a programmer for the while I was there, and a programmer when I was in college. And so I'm a techie person. And I love technology, so I'm definitely, you know, an apps person. You know, what's the app? There must be an app that can do this thing that I don't want to do. I am really interested in learning ways that women and girls can connect, communicate, and collaborate through different types of narrative villages globally. So I'm wandering around mobile technology that will create that. And so there are some spaces of research and study that I'm looking to get into to explore the area, the way that we could use digital and particular mobile technology as a way to connect our storytelling. I mean, there are different platforms available that you can use for that, but nothing quite as creative and imaginary that I have sitting in my head. And I go, I bet you I can make that happen. And I think I will.
I bet you can. And I'm looking forward to seeing you do it. That doesn't sound a lot like a slowing down. Sounds like you're speeding up. And I want to ask you, because I know there'll be some young people listening who want to be you when they grow up. What advice do you have for young writers who, you know, have stories inside them and they want to get them out, and maybe they're running into people who are saying, but you have to earn a living and all that? What do you say to your young self or people who are just starting out on that journey?
I guess there's almost two questions in that for me. So the one thing I'd say to all writers, and I'd say to all women and all writers, so I'll just put it that way, women and girls and writers, tell yourself the truth. Don't live in a pretend world. Just be honest and truthful to yourself. And it took me a while to tell myself the real truth in my journal. Like, I was writing down all the ways that my life was so wonderful, and I wasn't really owning up to my feelings. Even if it didn't make sense, and not to judge it, just to really kind of own it. So write yourself the truth. Tell yourself the truth in your journal. Even if you're pretending to someone else, even if you're into this like Southern hospitality thing that happens here, which is, you know, it's hard for me to navigate. Not being from the South, when people being Southern polite. And so what, I'm just really kind of a, you know, could be abrasive maybe from other people's perspective. But for me, it's just being who I am. And so, you know, just tell yourself the truth somewhere. In terms of people who are being told, you know, hey, you know, how are you going to earn a living? There's so much evidence to support the arts in earning a living that we need to get out of this narrative. Yeah. Yeah. When you think about just the fact that we have a Silicon Valley technology, that all took creativity to kind of put that together. You know, when you think about the sciences, you know, experiments comes out of a curiosity and the desire to create. So creativity and arts is how stuff evolves and comes to be. And so we have to appreciate the fact that our creative self is an important part of ourselves. In terms of doing work in the field of arts, do your homework. Understand the different types of opportunities and careers in the arts and what does that mean in terms of earning potential. You know, I'm a writer. There are people who need content in everywhere and they don't want it articulated in a way that's boring. They want someone to be able to tell a powerful story. And so how are you practicing your craft as a writer to write a powerful story? One that really presents an organization or a person. You've heard of branding. You know, how are you articulating a product, a service, or an individual in their most powerful best self and using language that really catches people? How creative can you be around that? So part of this is understanding that there are a variety of ways that you can earn a living in the arts. That's both commercially and as well as artistic. You know, people like fiction and poetry and essay and have a strong desire to read good fiction and poetry and essay. So people want to read something that takes them to a different place that they normally don't get a chance to do. So there is a space in the world. We also have to think about work is not this job that you're going to be on for 50 years and get a retirement. You know, that's not going to happen. What kind of work are you pulling together for your life? I like the fact that I get to do what I call project-based work as a way that I do and earn my work in the world. And I'm able to earn a living out of doing that. And it's something that's very smart and strategic. And, you know, I get paid for the work. I just make sure that people understand that I'm not there to do this work for free, that right. This is not what I do. If I choose to do something for free, that I want to gift an organization something or do it for pro bono, that's a decision that I made, but I'm not, you know, doing a public relations or what did you call it for? You used the word opportunity to show your skills or, you know.
For exposure.
Yeah, that's what it was, the exposure. Yeah. That was something new. I said, oh, we do this for exposure. I go, what's that? Yeah. That sounds kind of seedy, actually,
yeah,
doesn't it?
I know. So, people will say, you know, but yeah. you're if you do this thing, you know, the writer will be exposed to the world or the artist will, you know, your art will be out there. And it's like, I don't want my art out there for free.
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
And we have to get away from that. And the whole concept of earning a living is something that's very Puritan American stuff too. It's you ask someone from a Western European country what they do for a living. And they look at you and they, their brow will furrow.
Yeah.
You know, existing is enough.
Right,
and,
exactly.
I don't have to earn my right to exist. Oh, you mean my job? What is my job?
What is my job? Yeah.
Earn a living. What is that? Only in America do we have to, you know, prove our worth to breathe in and out or something. I don't know. I'm getting off topic.
No, it's very much on topic because I think that's the thing that dissuades people. Mm-hmm. And the last thing I would recommend for young people is to get a mentor. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so many programs. You look at organizations like Gen Wow, the mentoring aspect. We have a conference in November every year for girls, high school girls, Well, you can attend and you can grab a mentor. You have mm-hmm. big brothers, big sisters. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are organizations in town where people are there to mentor young people, to kind of give them an idea of what's possible. So there are people out here for young folk. All we have to do is just say, hey, I want a mentor. And you can mm-hmm. get someone that will spend some time with you. That's I enjoy wonderful. Mentoring young people.
I can tell you do, and a lot of people have been blessed by your help and your wisdom. Well, I could talk to you all day, but I'm getting the signal that we have reached our hour in Scribbler's Corner at River of Grass, so I'm going to thank you for coming, and just say we're looking forward to what's next.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. And thank you for the work that you're doing and engaging writers here in Jacksonville. Your work here, particularly at Jacks by Jacks, is just outstanding. I have loved working with you and pulling that together. And I can't wait. This year will be fabulous. So thank
Let's
you.
Let's do it. Thank you.
Scribbler's Corner is produced by Brad Kuhn and Associates, a multimedia production company, making authors' dreams come true for almost a decade. BKNA offers a full print shop with design services for everything from books to bookmarks and banners, digital audio recording, video book trailers, and animation, priced for self-published authors and indie publishers. The Corner is also brought to you by the Jacks by Jacks Literary Arts Festival, Jacksonville Writers Writing Jacksonville, now in its sixth year. Writer applications open July 1st for this year's event, which will be held on Saturday, November 16th. And finally, a podcast wouldn't be a podcast without listeners like you. If you like what you're hearing and want me to keep doing it, please do me the favor of subscribing and spreading the word by telling at least one friend about us.